Hello, this is In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life with Sheila Bender. Today, we're talking with Dennis Must, a short fiction and novelist writer from Massachusetts. We've interviewed him before, and we're happy to interview him today because he has a second novel out. He is the author of two short story collections, Oh, Don't Ask Why, from Red Hen Press in 2007, and Banjo Grease, Creative Arts Book Company, Berkeley, California. His first novel, The World's Smallest Bible, was published by Red Hen Press in March of 2014. His plays have been performed off-Broadway, and his fiction has appeared in numerous anthologies and literary reviews. He was born and raised in Newcastle, Pennsylvania, a thriving mill town. Dennis graduated in 1956 from Washington and Jefferson College, Washington, Pennsylvania. Following 2 years at Princeton Theological Seminary, he decided against entering the clergy to attend the Playwrights Workshop at the University of Iowa, Iowa City. Thereafter, he taught at various locations in Pittsburgh and then in New York City while writing, directing, and co-producing his own plays with artist collaborator, the late John Hawkins. Night Moths, their final production, opened at West Beth Theater, Bank Street, in Greenwich Village in 1974. In addition to writing, teaching, and selling real estate, Dennis Must has been a cabinet maker, short order cook, lightning rod installer, florist, bartender, bellhop, and a general laborer in the glass factory, steel mill, on highway construction, and on the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. You can visit him at www.dennismust.com, but first today, we're lucky to be able to visit him by phone from his home in Massachusetts. Welcome, Dennis.
Thank you, Sheila. So happy to be here.
As much as I am eager to get on to talking about your second novel published this year, I want to talk to you about your connection to the West Coast. I've been noticing that your publishers are from California and Washington. We have a Los Angeles publisher, Red Hen Press, and then Coffeetown.
The first time somebody has asked me this question, it's really wonderful that you did, because I can't answer the question why. Since I'm an East Coast writer, you'd think that the 300 stories or so that have been published, most of them would be, or the bulk of them would be, on this side of the States. But most of my work has been accepted and published by West Coast presses, which is really quite wonderful.
Yes.
Maybe it says something about the East and the West here. I'm not certain.
Well, one thing it says is that the West Coast has a lively publishing component, and most of us think of the New York scene as the publishing scene. So one thing it says to me is we have a publishing scene out here, and it's,
yes, indeed,
a worthy one. So Hush Now, Don't Explain is a novel that takes place in Ohio, correct?
Yes.
And I thought maybe a very good way for us to discuss this new book is for you to read from it. And after we hear a little bit about the characters and setting, I'll have a lot more questions for you.
Okay.
Would you like to read?
Yes. Briefly, as a prelude to my reading, the novel does concern about racial issues. One of the characters in the book, friends of the narrator and her relation, as it were, is a black man who was forced away from his little store on the street, his little shanty store, when the Ku Klux Klan visited Ohio, which in fact they did in the 1940s. They had a large coven there. And so that's where he has escaped from that street, as it were, to save himself. And he's been living on a little boat, a little dinghy that he patched together, and out on this lake, which is not too far from them. And so that's where I'm beginning. Both Honor, who is the narrator, and her very close friend, Billy, have been living for a while because of this problem, and getting ready to leave the area, have been living on the lakeside in a little place that they have made for themselves. We sat up. We watched the tin and tar patched dinghy move in fits and starts across the lake. At one point, when the wind had completely died, an oar carved out of plank dipped into the water, paddling forward. Offering Billy his hand, Augustus Willard stepped onto our shore, in cap-toed Oxford spit-shined, a double-breasted blue serge suit, crisp white shirt fastened tight to his, Adam's apple with a gold stud, no tie, and what little hair he had left slicked tight to his mahogany skull with a sweet aromatic oil. "I've come for dinner," he ceremoniously announced, In my little cockle shell, you'll find a Sterno grill, fresh sunnies, a bottle of blush wine, one can of beans. Our old friend had risen from the dead, and that's just the way we felt, for neither of us were certain he hadn't. Oh, it's me, all right. Been keeping my eye on you two for some time, and I got to reflecting on the other side of the pond, he continued. Those two can't be going out into the world alone when they ain't ever been anywhere. So I brought my valise, too, one with stickers of every grand city in this land. After we be cooking ourselves a bouquet under the deforest skies, you, Honor, and Billy can be seeing which one of those decals captures your fancy. Mr. Willard put on an apron and fried the sunnies in real butter and chopped onions. We had cornbread, too. Didn't ask him where he came upon those victuals. The wine warmed us real good. We were afraid we'd never see you again, I said. Well, I ain't run off like the sheets believe I did, he confessed. He pointed to the beach craft and its sail. They gave me inspiration, he laughed. A man could slip in and out of the coves around here a lifetime and nobody ever know. Soon enough, forget to care. All my friends fled to Warren, Ohio. Not Augusta Willard, oh no. I see some of them now and then. Just a matter of strolling up the tracks. Only thing I do miss is the socializing. I detected a wistfulness as his words trailed off in the evening breeze. He studied me closely, but now he looked even more unsure. Honor, got a haircut, I see. Mighty handsome one, too. Billy nodded. You want to come, Mr. Willard? Oh, afraid I won't be able to afford the accommodations, he said. What accommodations, I asked. Well, not that I disapprove of it, certainly not. It's the right honorable way of traveling, he said. You saying you'd be a drag, Billy exclaimed? The old man nodded. The light from the Sterno can cast a gas-blue glow on his face. But we don't know where we're going, I said, and you do. He studied our faces for the longest time, probing our sincerity. The wind had risen over the lake and was snapping the bedsheet sail. Well, the snow and ice will soon be affecting my accommodations here at the pond. I took hold of his hand. Will you promise Mr. Willard one thing, he said. We nodded. If me and my valise get too burdensome for either of you to carry, will you just let me be? What do you mean, let you be, I cried. He lifted a pack of cigarette, Lucky Strikes, from his suit pocket and offered us a smoke. With a thumbnail that shined like pearl, he flicked a match alive. I mean journeying on, because I've been to wherever you're headed. Chi-Town, KC, the Big Apple, so it ain't a big deal if I don't ever arrive. You see? Then you just let me be and say goodbye. He stood, tipped his imaginary hat, ambled back to his boat, lay down inside its hull, and smiled up at us, gesturing we push him off. Somewhere out in the water, the sepulchral voice came drifting back. Light the Sterno can when you're ready to leave. Write it in the sky so I'll be able to see. When that day comes, I'll meet you at the junction.
Thank you, Dennis. Do you want to fill us in any more about the setting and the decade that this is set in?
The setting takes place in and immediately around this so-called DeForest Junction, the cousin's Ohio home. Two doors down from their Victorian boarding house, where passing through trainmen rented rooms, stood this corrugated shack whose Mr. Willard's, where he sold bread and milk, eggs, and soda pop. And immediately across the tracks was a roundhouse for repairing locomotives, and on the other side of the road, a bordello. And this novel follows Honor, the narrator, from her youth in the mid-40s right through the early 70s.
Okay, that's quite a bit of time. What intrigued you about that time, those decades, or another way of saying that is, how did this story come to you?
Yeah, what happened is it was so unlike where I was growing up. And as a young boy in the mid-90s, during the summers, I'd spend a good part of the summers there with these very distant cousins, three girls a bit older than I was. And they were related in some respect to my mother. And they lived in, again, on the outskirts of town along these tracks. And the neighbors were, like themselves, very poor. And they were also there were whites and blacks who lived quite harmoniously on the street. They were so poor that the sewage from their houses ran down an open ditch alongside the road. But it all seemed so natural there. And then late one night, we were awakened. I was young enough then to, I wasn't self-conscious, and the four of us slept in one bed in the attic, and we were awakened to look across the field and see these white-robed Ku Klux Klan men torch a cross right across from our house. And the morning following the burning, even as children, we knew something ominous and evil had descended upon the neighborhood, and that probably our carefree summer days were about to come to an end.
Wow. What decade was your experience with this?
This is 1940s.
I'm reminded of a Paris Review interview with the author Faulkner, who said that each of his stories for his novels started with a kernel, some image that struck him. And as I listen to you speak, I'm imagining that this was the kernel of your story.
What's so interesting about it is, for me, is that I was listening one day to Billie Holiday and this song. She began singing "Hush Now, Don't Explain," and that whole period came rushing back to me. And I thought, oh, it is so indelible in my mind. And I thought, oh, I have to write about this. But the problem was is that because of our youth at the time, and the lack of awareness of, for the most part, of being both one boy among three girls who were about my same age. They were either younger, a year younger or two, or one was older. And I thought, but the only way I'm going to be able to do this is to try to write like one of them, to become a girl. Mm. And so that was the challenge.
That's very interesting to me because, of course, that was one of my questions, is how did you choose a female narrator? And now we know the backstory.
Yes, and part of that is that I, since that time, I've come across other writers who have done the same thing, and one of them is, I don't know whether you know Jim Harrison's work.
Yes, I do.
And two books that he wrote that were penned in a female voice. One was Delva, D-A-L-V-A, and the novella was The Woman Lit by Fireflies. And he writes, there are some doors a man can open only by being a woman. And that's exactly what I felt like. And he goes on to say that he cites Carl Jung, the psychotherapist. Jung asked this question, what have we done with our twin sisters that the culture forces us to abandon at birth? And Harrison answers, perhaps in my work, in The Voice of a Woman, I was trying to revive the ghost that the culture steals from us. So it's all in that, from that very same place.
Right. And it's interesting for me listening to you to remember that there is a long segment in the book where Honor, the female protagonist, dresses as a boy.
Yes.
So that's kind of an interesting juncture, too, of
yes,
this thinking.
Yes, yes.
Anything you want to say about that, her need to do that?
Of course, part of the tension for her is that she's fighting against becoming the fighting against becoming a woman that's essentially lives to satisfy her partner, a man. And she's, of course, very opposed to that. And it's part of the reason why she adapts a male identity and seems comfortable with that. But then at a certain point when they're in the New York City and they're going down by Rockefeller Center, and she looks around and she sees these beautiful women, and she sees her close friends, you know, her very close friends, Billy and Mr. Willer, eyeing up these women. And then that part of her becomes alive. And that whole section in the Bowery Hotel where she confronts the prostitute who is sitting there waiting for customers, and that woman takes her in a room and lets her dress up as a woman in her clothes, in the prostitute's clothes, and she feels so alive about that time. That was a very exciting part for me to write.
It's a very vivid scene.
I felt like
scene.
I was really right inside
yeah.
there.
Thank you for letting us know all that. And I know for me that was also a very vivid scene. And then the reaction of the two men when she shows them her new costume.
Exactly.
So would it be fair to say then that your novel is a coming-of-age story, a story about...
Yes, I think it's very fair to say.
That includes an acceptance of sexuality, a fulfillment of freedom with all of its parameters, actually... And music. We haven't talked about the place of music in your novel, though you did talk about the title coming from Billie Holiday and the way you're remembering the Ku Klux Klan event came through when you heard that music from that era.
How that occurred, the other person in that house was the cousin's much older brother, who was a self-taught piano player and was really extraordinary pianist. Who played jazz, and as a young boy in that house, listening to him simply getting out of bed and going down and playing, listening to a jazz pianist on the radio, and then going and doing exactly what he heard on the radio, just to use a phrase, sort of blew my mind. I thought, oh my God. And that was my introduction to jazz. So that weaves like a primary thread through the whole book. He also played in to earn a living as he was still a young man, but you know, we were still in the late teens, and he had an organ, a Hammond B3 organ, which, as you perhaps know, is well known in earlier jazz trios, and he would haul it behind his old car and play at different houses and also at roller rinks. That was where that whole section on roller rink
right.
came from.
So the character, your character, Billy, the close friend of honor, is in fact very heavily
in
based
many
on
respects,
your cousin.
Yes.
Yeah, that's exciting to learn, but not all respects.
Well, pretty not all respects in that where Billy is black and white, right? The cousin was not. They were white. Part of the whole bringing together of the blacks and whites in that book is that one of the wonderful things about this house where I'd stay in all those summers, Sheila, is that there'd be card games virtually every night in the house, in that house, in this big old house. And around that table would be my so-called aunt and her husband and a couple black neighbors sitting there. It was just like it was idyllic. I don't mean to be simplistic about it, but it was like when I went there, it was like another time, another place. So the fact that what was so wonderful about it is that there was very, very little parental concern about how our young lives would go. We would get up in the morning and feed ourselves, and we were off, and would return home sometimes late at night. We'd be fishing a lot, and spending time together. It was sort of a childhood fantasy in many respects.
Dennis, that explains to me why there were many times in the book when I was remembering Huckleberry Finn. Probably the boat, the fishing, the freedom.
Yes.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed that. One thing that isn't idyllic that we haven't discussed yet about the book is that these two cousins in your book, the children in your book, who grow to adulthood over the course of the novel, are both searching for parents. I wondered about that thread in here.
It certainly isn't a direct experience in my life. I don't think I can address that, Sheila.
Thank you, Dennis. It's really fine, because my next question is going to be, if you think about this at all, what is the difference between writing a novel that is crystallized because of life experience and memory and a memoir, which is trying very hard to do the truth of a life, as opposed to fiction, where you get to invent devices that you help you explore the human spirit? It's a question that I'm asked a lot as a nonfiction writer, and I was wondering if you might have anything to say about that. And if you don't, it's fine too, because I think writing is very magical and mystical, and we never really quite understand why it's come to us.
No. And am I understanding you? Are you asking me to sort of see if there is a connection between memoir and a more novelistic form?
Well,
is that what you're asking?
That is a cousin of what I'm asking, and that would be very interesting to me if you wanted to address it.
From all of my experience, the four books I've done, and I think we talked about it in the earlier interview, that I tend to write very close to, for want of a better term, the autobiographical bone. Also, what directs me is what Anais Nin, the novelist and close friend of Henry Miller, writes, is that she said, we write to taste life twice. And that's really what pushes me to sit down and work many hours each day, just to go back and to see if I can catch lightning again, and then catching it to dissimulate it in words to the point that maybe I can discover something that I didn't understand at the time. And the difference between, for example, like the earlier book, the earlier novel, there was very close to my life with my now deceased brother, where this is more of a traditional novel form that I do. There's a lot of invention that does occur there. But I must tell you is in most of the scenes that are very, very strong, they have their origin in what indeed happened.
Thank you. It's always thrilling to hear the backstory to writing. The book goes out without you, as it should, and it has a fullness of its own. But it's very heartening as a writer and as a reader to hear where in life the story comes from. So I thank you for revealing that. And I have another question, which is an easy one, I think, for you to answer, and that is, how long did it take you to write the story once you had the image and the music?
Most of my writing occurs in rewriting.
Uh-huh.
And by that, and I know you as a writer can understand this, is that when I write, for example, this book, it came out quite rapidly. I probably had the first draft within, I'd say, 3 or 4 months or so. Over 2 years, at least, I worked on rewriting it. And essentially, the whole end, and from New Orleans on, that took quite a while to make that work for me. And then having done it, having got there where I felt reasonably comfortable with it, the thing that concerned me most was Honor's voice, that I perhaps was taking too much of a risk in thinking that I could write a book in a young girl's voice, being close to, well, now 80 years old, but then when I wrote it, it was written in about 2007 or so. I was fortunate to find a woman author whose work I respect a lot, literary fiction, and also who functions as an editor and has been an editor for a number of years and has taught at various universities, and to have her vetted, as it were. And so we worked together for several months. I wanted a woman to say, yes, this is a woman's voice. This is a young woman's voice. And once I was assured of that, then I began to seek a publisher.
Good. Were there moments where she said, oh, no, that isn't right?
Well, it wasn't so much that. It wasn't so much a woman's voice. See, occasionally when it became a little too phantasmagorical, as it were, at some parts, in that whole, for example, that whole scene where Honor is hallucinating and she becomes ill in New Orleans, this editor had initially a problem with that, but eventually came around and thought, well, okay, I think I buy it.
It's tricky to write in, not only in a different gender's voice, but also in dialect. And I think you've done a good job. I felt convinced as I was reading it that I was in their world, and I think that's the most important part. Your background as a playwright intrigues me, a playwright turned fiction writer, novelist. As I read your book, I wondered about some of the ways that you do transitions that may be influenced by writing plays. And it could just be my imagination, or maybe you notice it too.
No, it's not. It's interesting how you pick these things up. The publisher of the last book, and who published the earlier collection and an earlier collection of stories, said, "Dennis, one of the reasons why I like your work is that you cut out the connections." And what's interesting also, Sheila, about it is that, and I think they were coming from the same place when Publishers Weekly did a review of the earlier novel, The World's Smallest Bible, said that, commented about it, that it this sort of had this episodic quality. And I think that's what they were referring to, scene shifting from one to another, where you really don't need the explanation between. I'm certain that's where that comes from.
So do you ever see your story as a play when you're writing it? I mean, not that you would write it as a play, but do you imagine characters coming on and off stage?
Well, I do, in fact. And what's fascinating to me about it is that when I decided that I wanted to write this in a young woman's voice, when I would come up to my study each morning to begin it, I would actually prepare myself as if I were ready to go on stage.
Huh. And what would that be?
To put myself, to work myself into her character. I was very, very influenced by Marlon Brando. Early on, my first experience that really awoke me as a creative soul, as it were, or wanting to create, was when I was about 15 or so, in a local movie house, I saw A Streetcar Named Desire. And when I saw him play that role, Stanley Kowalski, I walked out of that theater and I said to myself, my God, I can be somebody other than who I am. It was liberating to me. And from that point on, I began to, once I got into the theater more and had the opportunity to study Stanislavski and all of that, and it's simply about getting inside, finding a memory that will put you back in that time, and then working your character out of that memory. And that's exactly what I was doing. I was back in that house in DeForest Road and with one of those cousins and taking one of their voices. That's what it was about.
Well, you've given us a very, very valuable writing tip. Maybe all of us as writers ought to go right out and take an acting class and think about that, because that, is, for me, is a new way of listening to what you have to do to create a character. I mean, I've heard and read all kinds of advice about creating a backstory for them and, you know, really knowing things, including their horoscope sign. But I have never really heard it this way, and I really appreciate that you can be somebody different than you are, and you can base it on a memory, an emotional memory that brings you into collaboration with that other person that you can become.
Yes, that's what Actors Studio was all about, exactly that.
Okay, well, Dennis, thank you so much for your time today and for
being. Oh, it's a wonderful pleasure.
I have to say
you bring out the best of souls.
Well, thank you, but I know that your generosity in telling us about yourself as a writer and about the background of this story is so valuable and will inform those people who are going to be reading Hush Now, Don't Explain, a novel by Dennis Must. And you can visit Dennis Must's website at www.dennismust.com. And you will have a very valuable reading experience. So again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sheila.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.